stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
Thanks to Gary and Claire on the Laws of Life show, an excellent show as always. Good afternoon. It's now 1:07 p.m. and you're tuned into the Daily Maverick show on Cliff Central. My name is Kingsley Kipuri and I'll be your host for the next hour. Today I'm joined in studio by Daily Maverick associate editor Ranjeni Munasami and Daily Maverick contributor Gashwal Brooks. Gashwal, as always, good to have you on board. And Ranjeni, it's been a while since you've been. Welcome back.
I know, hey, and it's like the worst day ever to come in and talk politics when you want to scream about cricket.
I'm sorry, man. I don't know a hell of a lot about cricket, but I know it is a sad day. I do know that.
It was tragic. It was like a multiple tragedy, you know. It was so much went wrong, you know. You don't even know where to start to explain. Like if I had to say to you this, X is what happened. It would be X, Y, Z, A, B, C, D, you know, you start the whole alphabet. It's just so much went wrong.
But there was still hope. I think that's the big problem.
Yes,
there's still hope.
Right
up until the end.
Ball, yeah.
Up until the end. So I think we might maybe at the end observe a moment of silence for the end of the cricket World Cup.
I think that would be very
appropriate. It's appropriate. There we go. Gashwal, just before we begin, remember we're in civilized company today with Ranjeni, so let's behave with decorum. So no funny stuff. No, let's just keep it, you know.
Clean.
I'll behave.
Okay, he'll behave. Okay, we've got him on the record saying he'll behave.
As much as I can.
Now to go into our first topic, we'll be talking about the Roads Must Fall campaign, heading down the Western Cape and really the protest that we've been seeing at UCT. Just to give you an idea of the kind of atmosphere that's there right now, we'll just play a quick clip. Now, what you just heard there, the sounds of UCT students, the SRC, and accompanying students protesting for the removal of the Rhodes statue. The primary demand is really to have the statue gone and have that as the first step towards what they want as true transformation. I mean, Gashwal, I know you went to Rhodes. Is this something you've been watching?
No. I knew people from Rhodes University. I went to Wits.
You went to Wits. Okay, so you want to just be clear. You want to be clear about
that. Yeah, we're a little more progressive there. I don't know. You know what? I find it very interesting. And I don't know. It's the subject of my next column. So since it's
fantastic.
Unpublished, I don't know if Frank is going to be kind enough to put me out there. But the question that I just have is, in as much as we know what the gripe is and what the issues are, and this issue around Rhodes' legacy and what he represented, and what he represents, that is obviously the main question. But in as much as that's the situation, I'd really like to understand how a statue coming down really leads us down that path of real transformation.
Yeah, I think.
Because I think that in as much as it's symbolic, it's a starting point, but if that's the end game, and it really seems that there's a lot of attention focused on this, then I think it will all come to not nothing, but very little.
I think it's happening in the context of the broader race debate in the country. And I think that's why it's so significant. I think that the issues of race have somewhat fallen off the national agenda in the past few years and has been forced back by a number of things that have been colliding, and one of which has been racial incidents, particularly in Cape Town, and claims that institutions, restaurants are discriminatory against black people, particularly in the Western Cape. So I think it comes within a context and it must be seen as such. And in order to confront the race debate, there are various ways to do it, and the biggest way to confront it is via dialogue, and you don't find that that happening. There is somewhat of a resistance to dialogue on race issues. And you even find denial. I mean, I found it absurd that the mayor of Cape Town, Patricia de Lille, is asking the deputy president for evidence of racism in Cape Town when it screams at you everywhere.
I mean, that was quite worrying. And it's in this,
yes, exactly.
This strange open letter format that people seem to be favoring. And it's saying, where's the proof? Show us the proof so that we can investigate.
Exactly. You know, so this is the problem. And I think that the anger that you're seeing from the students at UCT at the moment is symbolic of the fact that there is this frustrated kind of scene around racism in the Western Cape, and there's no outlet for it. And I think that this what is happening about the on the road statue is symbolic of this broader debate on race.
Yeah, I mean, I like that you've mentioned symbols, because I think it's something that has been discussed, and we saw it with the De Klerk Street conversation. Is what is the power of symbols? What is the power of a statue, or naming an airport, or naming a street? Is it just simply stating that these things happened and we don't want to forget them, or is there more power in that? And I think that's a conversation that should be coming. I mean, what should we do? Should we not name anything after apartheid era leaders? Should we have a sort of different place where we put all the statues and all the names? And I think that's something that people are trying to grapple with. What do we do?
I think that, you know, the problem is that our country is so rich in history. Yeah. There's so much that's happened. Mm. And yet, I think, you know, there is somewhat of a failure in society to kind of appreciate and embrace what happened and how it happened and who did what. And therefore, when you have like an incident like the renaming of Table Bay Boulevard to F.W. de Klerk Street or whatever it's called, you find that people say, oh, well, he was a former president, so maybe he needs it. You know, there isn't a full appreciation of what exactly happened. What was de Klerk's role in South Africa before he became president, during his presidency, and after he became president, and why there is that resistance to him. People just see him as a former president. Oh, what's wrong with him being a street being named after him? And the same happens with roads. Is that, you know, you see all these things that are named after roads. Yeah, there's the Mandela Roads Foundation and things, and people say, oh, what's wrong with him? Like, you know, he gave land to UCT, and there isn't an
favorite argument.
Yeah, there isn't a full appreciation. And people don't have the knowledge of what exactly happened as to why it is so offensive for that statue to be there.
But so you think, Gashu.
I just wanted to ask this question. This is a question that I'm asking broadly in terms of activism, right? So we're sitting here and we've been discussing the statue now for a good 2-3 weeks. Yeah. Remember when what my sort of the look on my face was when we said that we're going to talk about the statue issue. And I think that a large portion of the debate, rather than dealing with the substantive issues around roads, around race, and all those other factors that Ranjani made mention of, that really needs to be discussed. A large portion of the debate has been spent on substantiation and trying to explain why the UCT
students... Why would this
students,
be offensive?
Exactly. What is the issue? Exactly. And I mean, I watched a news clip this morning, and there was a young lady on, and she was saying that, one of the students, and she was saying, well, the impact that the statue has on students, you know, the psychological impact. Well, if you're going to base your entire argument on that issue, then I'm sorry, you're not necessarily going to sell it to the general public, right? Because the question then is, what about all the other students that have come through this lengthy history at UCT, now that it's open and transformed, inverted commas, that have managed to pass the statue and manage to get their degrees and move on with their lives and then be very successful people. I think that the key issue, that issue of transformation and that race debate that we need to have, has been sideswiped by persistent substantiation. And of course, it doesn't help when you take poo and you hurl it at the statue, because then that now takes the debate down the sewer.
It's now who's a barbarian and who's a what. We're forgetting that there's deep structural issues that are at play here.
Exactly. And it just completely misses the point. So I do really think that for me, what this is really a case study of is how activism sometimes needs to understand that they need to capture an audience.
But it's also, I think, the methods of protest in our country. There is a lot of anger on a lot of issues. And in many ways, I think South African society has become accustomed to protest action. I think the only time when something out of the ordinary happens, and then there is the rest of society pays attention. So Marikana, people get shot dead. Oh, something happened there. But then we move on from it very, very rapidly. So here, these poor protests, the people who are embarking on it see it as a desperate measure, a last resort in order to get national attention. And unfortunately, unfortunately, society has paid attention only under extreme circumstances.
I mean, it works. In the Washington Post, yeah. Al Jazeera, and the yeah. thing is, it works. So it sort of reinforces itself that this is how you get attention.
But even the definition of it's working, I find it very interesting because, we're paying attention, right? Mm. We are paying attention.
Yeah.
But the question is, whatever your outcome is, that positive outcome that you want, are you actually going to achieve it? Because what I'm really worried about now is that you have a bunch of students who have an academic career, right? Yeah. That have an academic life, that have now staged a sit-in or lock-in at the offices, and they're obviously not studying and all kind. I promise you, what easily happens in situations, and I've seen this because I myself was a student once upon a time, and we at WITS, as progressive as we were, had our fair share of, protests. Right? We had our fair share of protests as well. And what did you find? Usually, the protesters were labeled easily after lengthy protests that they were the flunkies anyway. You know, that it was a bunch of guys that were failing their courses. And you know what? This was a diversion from it so that they can go back to the counseling units and say, well, guess what? You know, we were protesting and fighting for our fellow students, and this is why this thing didn't work out. I think that they need to make a big enough deal of this so that we can see real change, and that, yes, maybe the statue should go down.
Yeah.
But do it in such a way that you actually achieve the outcomes. So, I'm giving a lecture on activism, but that is really what it needs to boil.
I think in terms of effectiveness, it has been somewhat effective because suddenly the vice chancellor of UCT, Max Price, is supporting the move. The gestures and the sounds he's making as if he supports the statue coming down. But I think the question to be asked now is then what happens?
What now?
That's the thing.
You see, so, I mean, there needs to be some method in this madness because you take the statue down and then do what with it? Where do you put it? And then what happens to other statues? The EFF, for example, has been campaigning for the statue of Louis Botha, who they call Louis Botha, to come down outside Parliament.
Yes, at the front Parliament. Entrance, yes, absolutely.
Front entrance of Parliament. Yeah. And for 20 years, nobody said a thing about it. It was just there.
That's the thing. These things have always been there. Nobody really
like I walked past there 50 times, you know, just like, oh, all whatever. Right. Like, you know, you don't even notice it. And suddenly the EFF, I think it was Julius Malema's maiden speech, and he said, and he says the statue of Louis Botha must come down. And everyone was like, what? Who?
Which statue? So, yeah. Oh, that one.
Yeah, exactly.
Which Formula One driver?
I know, right?
So, you know, it is an interesting debate, and I think that society needs to grapple with this broader debate of race, of what is to be done with apartheid symbols, but also in dealing with history, passing down information and knowledge about our history to the next generations. To the credit of the UCT students, it seems that at least the protest leaders seem to know what's going on. They have their, you know, they're very knowledgeable about what they're doing. I don't think it's just, you know, bunking classes. They're doing it with the full facts at their disposal. I mean, if you listen to their interviews, they know exactly why they're doing this and what they want must happen next. So, and the thing is that it's spilling over to other campuses as well. So it is lighting some kind of fire in the country, and I think it would be a great tragedy if that is just left to lie after this.
I mean, absolutely. Gaswell raises his hand.
Yes,
that's it. That's decorum. That's it. That's it.
Yeah. Just one question though. Yeah. So let's assume that UCT sits down and, I don't want to start conspiracy theory, but let's say the management gets together and they sit down together and they say, okay, you know what? Let's give them what they want. Take down the statue. We'll move it to a less prominent spot.
Whatever.
On
we'll
campus.
Move it or we'll take it down. Whatever.
What next? What next? Because now, remember, we've been going on about the statue issue. That symbol and the symbolism behind it has been removed, or it has been, neutralized at the minimum. The real question is, what next? Does that change UCT as an institution? Because I think that is the broad debate that really should be held here, you know? I mean, with all due respect to the good Dr. Mampela Rampela, who was the former leader of AHANG, who was also, and you'll correct me here, Ranjani, she was chancellor of the University of UCT.
Chancellor, yes.
Chancellor at UCT. You know, saying that, no, it's transformed, it's a wonderful place. We know our Ivy League universities are not necessarily the best example for transformation. Whether you talk about staff, whether you talk about students from previously disadvantaged communities getting into the university, but the question is, do they get out with those necessary degrees? Mm. And the reason why they're not getting out with those necessary degrees And believe me, I was there. I understand what happens. I lived in men's res, which is the tough of the tough. You know, where all us bunch from the far-flung parts of the country live huddled in this one little res. The problem is, guys don't get those degrees, not because they're not studying hard, not because they're drinking every weekend. It's because it's a major life adjustment. And the question is, are you introducing programs to help those students? Is that, because that for me is real transformation. Not just a statue. I'm not saying that the statue is irrelevant. Mm. I'm saying, but it shouldn't end there. But I'm telling you, unfortunately, you know, if I had to be in that war room, you know, on the other side, the UCT side, the management side, I'd have said, take down the statue.
And forget it.
Forget it. They'll go home.
I think I definitely agree with you there. I'm very worried that we may lose the real cause here, which is broad transformation. How many black professors do we have? Mm. What are the conditions of the black staff? What is happening to non-white kids from rural areas, from townships? What happens when they get to UCT? And that's not being discussed right now.
So, and they're not surviving. I can tell you. A small number of those kids are surviving. That I can guarantee.
If you're just joining us now, we're discussing the Roads Must Fall campaign. We're trying to get a hold of the UCT SRC president. Not being successful. I think they're still busy with the sitting they're staging right now in the admin block. I'm joined by Gashwell Brooks and Jenny Munasami. So I think in conclusion, it sounds like we're encouraged by the kind of student activism we're seeing, but we're worried that the end game may be lost here.
I think that the next debate will be about the name of Rhodes University. I think that's where it'll move next. So I think it's gonna be very kind of top end, the issues. I don't think that will be like grappling with these real issues you're talking about. You know, the throughput of students, the kind of support students get, financial, you know, and otherwise, and how many of them make it through the system. I think that will fall through the cracks. I think we're gonna have a basically very cosmetic kind of debate on this issue.
But don't you think, Ranjani, that most of these things end up being like that? Because now, you know, because you know what the thing is, and this is what I wanted to say about activism from the onset, is that if you don't have societal buy-in, if the rest of society doesn't understand what it's all about, what you're trying to achieve, and it doesn't make sense to society, then they're not going to give you that support. You know, that's why I'm saying that, with all due respect, but, you know, the admin of UCT, the guys in charge, you know, don't really have to do much. They can sit back and say that you're not to be fine. It's all about a statue. That's what we're going to make it about. Because really, let's be honest, the public debate has been about a statue. If I do talk radio, people call me in and they try to explain to me why the statue should stay. And then others call in to tell me why the statue needs to go down. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking to myself, guys, really? A piece of metal. A crafted piece of metal. That's what we've boiled this thing down to. And that for me is the most concerning aspect to this.
That's it for this half of the show, discussing the Roads Must Fall campaign. I'm going to go into the break and we'll be back soon. You're tuned in to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. I'm joined by Gashwell Brooks and Ranjani Munasami. We just had a brief conversation on the Roads Must Fall campaign going on in UCT. Gashwell's laughing at me.
I'm not laughing at you. I was hoping that I wasn't going to be quoted off air. That's why you said we were having a conversation. No, like, oh, here we go.
Roads Must Fall campaign. What happens on the break stays on the break.
For sure.
Now we want to turn to something a bit different. We recently lost our Minister of Public Service and Administration, Honorable Shabane, and Ranjani, you've been working on digging into on what happens now. What is the political fallout? What are the consequences? I think one thing you've highlighted is that the relationship between the president and Honorable Shabane was not a regular one. It was not a purely work one. There seemed to be quite a sort of strong bond there.
And you know, the strange thing, Kingsley, is that nobody knew there was this like tight relationship that he was the main man, you know, until he died. It's so bizarre because, you know, he was a soft spoken, unassuming guy, you know. I remember like being in some meeting where there were a lot of cabinet ministers. He was sitting behind me and suddenly he tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Hey, I'm going," because he was so bored, you know. He couldn't stand being in the meeting, and then You know, for some reason he decides to tell me it's going like
okay. Thanks for letting me know.
But, you know, it was just that kind of. It was just like, you know, one of the guys. You know, you would never know that he had that much power and influence, particularly over the president. And you know, when the president was in all sorts of trouble, for example, you know, with his rape trial and the criminal trial, and you know, you never see people like Chabane around, like screaming, you know, like in the way other people used to be. You know, screaming from the microphones and saying we were killed for Zuma and all those kinds of things. So he was very much a kind of backroom operator. Yeah. After Zuma was elected ANC president at the Polokwane conference in 2007, and then you suddenly saw the rise of Collins Chabane, because he then led this task team that was putting in place a plan to change the structure of government in the way in line with the ANC resolutions from the Polokwane conference, but also in terms of what the big boss wanted, the incoming President Zuma's preparing to take over power a year and a half after the Polokwane conference. So he then appointed his point man to kind of design the structure. That's how you saw this kind of rejigged structure in government, with new departments being introduced. Absolutely. And also the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation. And you know, Zuma doesn't really talk about how he appoints people, why he appoints people, like the process he goes through, because cabinet appointments are purely his prerogative. Yes. So all you know is that, you know, he has a conversation at some point with Gwede Mantashe, and then you know,
it's done.
Calls people up and say, you're it, you know, that's basically all we know about it. So it was quite interesting at the funeral to hear him say that he actually thought at some stage that he wanted to appoint Collins Chabane as his director general in the presidency. Wow. So basically he would have been the person running his office, managing where he goes, what he says, what he does, you know. But then he decided that even that position wasn't powerful enough for Collins Chabane. And he wanted him to basically be the class prefect over the cabinet.
To run this
monitoring and evaluation ministry. And then he was saying that Chabane was submitting quarterly reports, you know, on the performance of other ministers. But the question to be asked then is, so what happened? How did you have this dying ducks in a thunderstorm, you know, through for 5 years, you know, people goofing off, you don't know what they're doing, what their job is. Like, for example, Lulu Klingwana in the Women's Ministry. I mean, I would have loved to see Collins Chabane's assessment
of
her.
You want to see that report, Kat. Yeah. You want to see that.
Yeah. So, you know, whatever it is that came up, because according to Zuma, what he was saying at the funeral is that quite a few of the cabinet colleagues were cross with Collins.
Wow.
Yeah, because they were angry with his assessments, you know. So obviously there were some things that he put out there, but the problem is Zuma didn't act on it. So he dropped the ball on it. So we could have had a really good operating system, you know. And then so after 2009, he decided to move him to public service and administration. And he says, Minister Chabane's passion was to get the frontline officers working optimally. So everybody who deals with the public, so at home affairs, at social development, you know, all the places where you have to queue.
Some reform at home affairs.
Exactly. And he says, you know, that's what he wanted to get right. So I think it's, you know, been a real tragedy that somebody who was there, who had some passion for what he was doing, who was committed, who, you know, wasn't there for the luxury cars and, you know, to take selfies and post them on Twitter, which is what you find some ministers doing now. You know, he was there quietly working, and it's a real tragedy, you know, that he had to be the one that goes. So I think, you know, there's a tough decision on the president now as to who he replaces him with. But, I, you know, the thing is that we all say that if there's one thing the president needs is, you know, some good advisors. And it seems that, you know, that the one good advisor he did have is now gone. So I don't know how you fill that gap.
I mean, you mentioned the president's appointment process is a black box. Nobody really knows what happens in there.
Right? Yeah.
At least not the public, rather. So, but can we expect, is it too optimistic to expect an appointment based on merit? I mean, we were lucky. It seems we had somebody who was there and actually was trying to fight the good fight and do the job. But I mean, unfortunately, we've seen so much alliance building and factionalism, and it seems that seems to be the basis decisions are made on.
That's the problem. You know, there's so many other criteria that go into to these processes. You know, who's in which faction, who's in vogue at the moment, who needs to you need to satisfy certain power networks. You need to satisfy gender balances, tribal balances, ethnic balances, all sorts of, you know, all these things come into play. So you never know. The other thing is that you must know that the ANC is preparing already on the road to its next elective conference in 2017. So it needs its power players to be in positions where they can pull strings. So, you know, this is why this cabinet appointment will be very interesting, because if you and I had to decide on it, we'll say, okay, let's look around cabinet and see who's weak there. So this is an opportunity for the president to be able to shift around the chess pieces, you know, and make some put you know, where people are quite you know, it's quite apparent that they're messing up, to move them out and put other people in. But he could go for a straight up you know, easy thing, just to promote the deputy minister of public service and administration and be done with it. Who knows?
So you mentioned the two ways this could go. I mean, is there? I know we know the president is a fan of the reshuffle. I mean, in his first term, we had four. We had four cabinet reshuffles.
Yes.
So is this, could you anticipate that potentially this could prompt a full on cabinet reshuffle?
Well, you know, you don't know where his head is at. Yeah. When I was watching him on Saturday, you could see that he was really, really affected by Chabane's death, you know, and it hit him hard. And because, you know, it happened so sudden, he said, for example, that when he got the message around 4 o'clock, and so he waited a while, and then he phoned Chabane's wife around 5, you know, and she hadn't heard by then. Nobody had broken the news to her. So can you imagine that shock to pick up the phone and the president's on the other line saying, "I'm so sorry, your husband's dead," you know? Yes. Can you imagine that? And then when, you know, on Zuma's part, to we have to say that and then realize that, you know, she didn't know as yet, you know, it's additional trauma to the whole fact. But you see, the thing is that all of this is unplanned now. And so, you know, he needs to be able to apply his mind to it, because you know, the thing is that in all his speeches, the narrative is, oh, we're doing very well, we've got a good story to tell, blah, blah, blah. But he can't be oblivious to the fact that, for example, the Minister of State Security is, you know, blundering through his portfolio. He clearly doesn't know what he's doing, you know, from the signal jamming to, like, using some fake website to start investigations against Thuli Madonsela. You do not need that guy as your minister. You know, in charge of state security, protecting the, you know, the security of the state. Can you imagine? It's like, you know, having Mr. Bean there. So it's just unbelievable. So, you know, that would be like one guy that definitely needs to move.
Okay.
The other person I think is Faith Mutambi, the Minister of Communications, because I think she, you know, she has an inherent misunderstanding of what communications means.
Of what exactly we're trying to do here. Yeah.
You know, if anything, she's been rubbing everybody up the wrong way and not communicating properly, you know. She's been disruptive to government's messages, any good messages that they have out there.
She's contrary.
Yeah, and, you know, it's so much so that I think even cabinet has been aware that she's not the best person in the job. So therefore, Minister Jeff Khadebe, the minister in the presidency, you see, has been addressing most of the government press conferences rather than the Minister of Communications, because I think, you know, they realize that the messages are just not penetrating. The other person that, you know, I would certainly have the crosshair.
Please don't say Ministry of Energy. Don't say Ministry of
definitely.
Energy.
Definitely. Where is this woman? Where is the Minister of
Energy?
Has
she said a thing? I can't say a thing.
I don't think she said a thing. How do you? How is it that we're in the middle of this power crisis? It's, you know, the biggest thing ever in South Africa, and the person in charge of energy doesn't have anything to say on energy. You know, it's bizarre.
But can I just ask a question? Because I mean, with that sterling CV that you just gave us on Collins Chabane.
Yes.
How has she survived all of these storms?
What? Yes.
I mean, if you have to think about it, it was fishery and forestry before this.
Yes.
Huge mess up.
Yes, and she has
absolute stuffer.
A report from the public protector hanging over her, which hasn't been acted on, and she still survives.
How does she do it? Because, you know, and that was what I was going to ask you, because you have these young rising stars. One would have assumed, because she's still relatively young herself, I mean, compared to the other ministers, Colin Shabani, Melusi Gigaba, sort of in the same camp. Am I correct there? You know, sort of the future of the ANC. That's where they were going to start investing. I mean, obviously,
and
we know Melusi.
And God help us all, Figile Mbalula.
I like
stuff selfies.
I like Razmataz. I like Minister Razmataz. And but I should say he's been very impressive on Twitter lately. But
I think today we had some restraint for him. We had support for the team.
He gave up long before the game was done.
He was done. He was just like, good job, guys. Thanks. Let's support the guys lost. It's like, it's not finished. He was just done.
The chief cheerleader like throws down his pom poms and walks off. You know, you can't have that.
But yes, how has she survived? I mean, what is the secret, Ranjini?
I think it's that she's in the right camp. I think she has the ear of the president. I think that she has some level of protection around her. But you know, the thing is that, and the other thing is that the Eskom crisis is firmly in the lap of Minister Lynn Brown as Public Enterprises Minister. So I think she's carrying the can a lot. But the thing is that what we have at the moment is a shortage of energy generation. There's a problem in the energy supply. She, as a Minister of Energy, should then be talking that side up. Yes, in terms of the management of the power utility, that may be Minister Brown's baby. But in terms of the power generation, that definitely should be Tina Jamaat-Peterson's responsibility, but she has nothing to say. And so, for example, the performance monitoring and evaluation responsibility has moved to the presidency. So all those people in the presidency, what must they been say? Because surely somebody, they will say, like, give her a nudge and say something, anything. And if she's not saying something, then I mean, surely people should be asking questions. Or what are you doing? What do you do every day?
I assume her defense is that she's working on it. We're in the middle of a crisis. I'm working on it. I don't have time to talk about it.
I can't recall a single public statement.
I don't think she said a single thing.
I've never seen this woman behind.
That's why I checked with Ranjit. To my limited knowledge, she hadn't said a single word.
I mean, I've been to press conferences at Megawatt Park where she had been there earlier, and when you ask these people, what did she say? And they were like, they just shrunk. Like, she just like popped up and left, you know? Right. So she, I don't think she is bringing anything to help or even to engage in this debate on the electricity crisis. She's just bringing nothing.
I mean, you would think, because every now and again in the Western Cape, we have a few power stations that need diesel every now and again. She should be the person saying, guys, organize some cheaper diesel.
Yeah.
You know, cheaper coal.
Yeah.
Something. I mean, at least you can come out and say,
talking up solar power, green energy. Anything. There's all these issues.
And things that are safe to say.
Yes.
Like green energy.
Exactly.
That's pretty safe.
It's uncontroversial.
In fact, you can just come out one day, just organize a press conference, green energy.
Yeah.
End of it.
A round of applause. End of it. The crowd goes,
well done. Well done.
But you know, this is the thing that if she has nothing to say, it means there's nothing going on there, you know?
I mean, I suppose you just appreciate the honesty. She's got nothing to tell us, and so she just doesn't say anything. But I think I can also just respect that. It's just like, guys, when I've got something, you'll hear from me. Until then, you know.
Yeah, but in the meantime,
the crisis continues.
In the meantime, she takes home a 2.2 million salary, you know?
So that's going to have me silent now.
No, 2.2 million would get me silent.
Yeah, guys,
I'd shut up.
You're blushing, man. What's happening here, dude?
I would shut
that figure
up.
Just affected you. Oh, man. Anyway, if you're just joining us, you're tuned into the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We talked a bit about the Roads Must Fall campaign. Now, briefly on the late Minister Colin Shabane and the impact of his passing on the cabinet and could we see some reshuffling there? Ranjini, I love you pointing out some of the sort of quote unquote weak ministries where we could see some changes: communication, state security, and energy. I think that's really something to watch.
Well, the other one is the police ministry, which leads into
Ranjini brings us to where we need to be.
Yeah, what is going on?
I get so confused. And I'm just like, so the police minister tries to get rid of Dramat and Sibiya, right?
Yes.
Both those decisions are overturned. They're both reinstated. So my question is, who is actually in charge of the Hawks right now?
The hawks are flying without wings.
I sat there and I was just like, who is, is it two people? Is it like, I think CBA is in hospital now for something separate. So is it when he gets checked out, he now takes over?
And
an acting head and an actual head.
Yeah. And Dramat hasn't been at the office because he's, you know, been still being suspended or voluntary suspension. Anyway, he's waiting for the matter to be resolved. And then there's a new player in this game or the shootout. Is Robert McBride, you know, because they then tried to suspend him. So, you know, it's been a complete and utter circus. And is there any wonder that there is a very noticeable spike in the crime rate? I mean, you have reporters being mugged on camera, and that's how brazen crime is now, you know? So, and the thing is that,
Debbie from Carte Blanche was mugged, for goodness sake.
Yes.
Who mugs her? Who? Who has the gall to say, I'm going to mug you?
But the thing is that, you know, I think that if government was playing whatever it is, this game that they're playing with the hawks and with everybody else that they, you know, the state of suspension we're in, they should have at least ensured that the business of government continues. So, for example, to do with the police ministry, the business of crime fighting should continue.
Absolutely.
But what you see is that, okay, you see that there are announcements now and then from the hawks that they've done this crime bust, that crime bust, and whatever. But can you imagine the morale within, I mean, they're the priority crimes unit. Can you imagine the morale amongst the country's top investigators when they know there is a hit on the highest ranking officials, both national and in Gauteng, from the politicians? Who then in those ranks would stick out their neck and want to do anything?
Yeah, or pursue the tough cases. Sorry, guys.
Exactly.
But Ranjini, you also mentioned earlier, remember, you just, state security is one of the ministries you would definitely chuck out, you know, ministers rather. I mean, the entire security cluster, police, state security, all of those guys coming together, there seems to have been a lot of chess playing in that arena.
Absolutely.
And that seems not to serve those priorities that you pointed out, like, for example, keeping, you know, big shot drug dealers out of the country, making sure that ISIS doesn't infiltrate the country. You know, they're not, and then obviously for people like you and I, making sure that people don't smash through my precast wall and take off with my generator. Mm. You know, those basics. That's not what it's been focused on. It's been focused on, look, I don't know, I don't trust Ranjani on all that much, you know, within this cabinet thing. So, you know what, I'm going to tap your phone, I'm going to... Mm. Is that still happening? Because I know with Mr. Mdluli, that was a huge issue. That's when he came out. Then we knew that those resources were being focused on...
There is a lot of skullduggery. For example, you know, the people I speak to in Kwasatu and NUMSA and things, they are so paranoid because they keep coming across incidences where the security picks up that they're under surveillance, they're being followed, their phones are tapped, their break-ins at their offices. So if you have that, that is purely political. It has nothing to do with crime. So if you have state agents then interfering on that level, can you imagine, you know, what's going on with the rest of us? I mean, you know, with the newsrooms, are they bugging the editors, for example? We saw the signal jamming going on, but, you know...
No, the Daily Maverick is definitely being bugged. I'm sorry. That cat is out of
the virtual office.
But, you know, when you think about people, you know, were heavily critical, where people are pursuing investigations. So, for example, News 24 has an investigations unit. Sunday Times has an investigation unit, and Amabungane, you know, which is attached to the Mail and Guardian. What must happen with those guys? I mean, surely, you can only imagine what's going on with them. So it makes you afraid about the state of our society, where the people who are in positions of power, in charge of the state apparatus, don't know what their jobs are. They think they are there to serve as a protection racket for the politicians rather than to protect the state and the national interest.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, just reading through what the Constitutional Court judge said about Mtandazo Mhlemeza, and it's, I just wanted to read it out because I can't remember reading something so just plain and blunt. And the reading is, in my view, the conduct of the third respondent, in brackets, Mhlemeza, shows that he is biased and dishonest, to further show that the respondent lacks integrity and honor, and he made false statements under oath.
Yes, I mean, how do you do that as a person fighting priority crimes and you make a false statement under oath, you know? But this shows there's also this desperation in the fight within the hawks and in the security cluster as a whole, because we don't know what is the reason that the police minister is, why he is so determined and desperate to get rid of Dramat and Sibiya? There is no, and I think, you know, what puzzles a lot of people more is that Dramat has, you know, quite a commendable reputation in MK. He was on Robben Island. He was tortured by, you know, the state, apartheid state police's, like, most notorious policemen. And he withstood all of those. He's somebody that...
That's a national, you know, and, hero. That's,
yes,
somebody we should really...
An NC government should, you know, say, hey, this is one of our guys.
One of ours, and let's... Mm.
What... The thing, the question that still has to be answered is, what has he done that has been so offensive? So the Minister of Police, Nathin Hleko, says, oh, it's about human rights. Hello, 34 people were shot down in Marikana. What happened to human rights there when the police were shot there?
You
know,
camera.
Where
so clearly,
is your concern, you know, about that?
That human,
you know,
rights,
or Andres Tatane, or, you know, all these this incidents of, yeah, police brutality. Yeah. You go and you pursue Dramat and Sibiya with
everything that happened in 2010.
In 2010, which the IPED report has, yeah, shown not to be true, that those two in particular cannot be held responsible. Mm-hmm. Then you fire the IPED head for that. You know, it's just completely and utterly bizarre. It makes absolutely no sense.
That's what I wanted to ask. I mean, what's the origin of this thing? All I ever hear is, and that's all, every single report, yeah, I've seen, and maybe this is, you know, showing my lacking and not doing my homework, but the rendition of Five Zimbabweans, if I'm not mistaken.
In 2010.
That is what keeps on coming up.
That's the cover story. And as Ranjani said, I mean, I don't think anybody's really buying it.
No, but we've written about this before. What it boils down to, if you trace back,
yeah,
is the reason, for example, that Robert McBride got suspended in the recent incident 2 weeks ago, is that he went to Sibiya's office. Sibiya phoned him and said that there were two crime intelligence agents wanting to remove some storage device from his office. So McBride then went there and asked, you know, whose device is it? He says, I mean, those cops then said it's Mluli's device that they were trying to remove. So McBride, as the head of IPED, then sees the device. 2 days later, he is then summoned to the minister's office in Cape Town to say, why did you take that thing? So, if you trace back, it's Mluli sitting somewhere saying, I want my device. Oh, so McBride took it, get rid of it. You know, that's what it appears to be. And suddenly the minister jumps because of some storage device. Can you imagine? You go all the way to the High Court to fight McBride because of a storage device that belongs to Mluli. And the questions over Dramat and Sibiya as well stems from their fight with Mluli, because they were engaged in a battle with Mluli. There've been allegations that this whole rendition story emanates from the Mluli camp. And so there's been this constant battle within the police, because Mluli keeps trying to get back to work, to get back his position, and he feels that these guys are standing in the way, and that they will sabotage him if he gets back into office.
So basically, just the state of our sort of security mechanism, police is at the mercy of Richard Mluli. Is what it sounds like.
Until
he decides, you know, we will not do anything here.
And this guy's Dr. Evil.
You know, we don't know why. There's no good explanation. But, you know, Richard Mluli worked for the apartheid police. He joined the police in the 70s. He has absolutely no link to the ANC. So why would the ANC bite off its own? Why would they, like, slaughter its own children for Mluli, an apartheid-era policeman? It just boggles the mind.
Isn't this the same guy that made a phone call to a particular gentleman not too long ago and said, I can guarantee you certain positions? Like, you know, remember the pre-Mangaung conference? Was it pre-Mangaung? Where Richard Mduli said that, you know, everything is sorted, don't worry, I'm making sure everything is working.
I can't remember that particular incident, but I remember that there was a sort of another fake intelligence report which emanated from him. Yeah, but I'm not sure about guaranteeing positions.
No, because I think that it was the issue of contestation, and there was, but I mean, you would obviously know much more than contestation leading up to Mangaung. The concern was that obviously there was Tokyo, there was Khalema coming through with their challenges, and Mluli supposedly made a phone call saying that, don't worry, it's all sorted, you're not really going to have a challenge. How Mluli was in a position to say that exactly, no one knows.
Mm.
But then, I mean, people started saying that they, I mean, remember Malema's famous quote, hello, Mthuli. Every time he answers the phone, he says hello.
There is a lot of paranoia at the moment because nobody knows quite who's running the show. There is a belief that people still loyal to Mthuli are there operating behind the scenes in the police, and that they are the ones that are kind of pulling the strings to get Sibiya and Ramat out.
I mean, at what point do we just have to bring it back to the president and listen and say, listen, the buck stops with you. What is happening?
Because
we can blame Richard Mluli and blame whoever, but at the end of the day, who was elected to be in this position?
I think that would have to be the next round of questions in Parliament to the president. Is that how much do you know about it? Are you aware of what Nhleko is doing? Is he doing this? Has he briefed you on it? Do you have full knowledge of what's going on and the impact this has on crime fighting? People asked him, I think, in the last round of questions to the president about there's so many heads of institutions. There's so many institutions that have no heads now, and he said that it's only a matter of time before like the special investigating unit and all these institutions are stabilized, but this hasn't happened yet. So this is the problem, is that the president it is very, very difficult to hold him to account. And in some ways, that's why it's unfortunate that, we constantly have this pay back the money thing on Kandla, because there's so much else that he needs to be held to account for. And much more serious issues such as, the National Prosecuting Authority, the Special Investigation Unit, the Hawks, all of them.
We had the issues with Eskom, we had the issues with SABC. So we've got a lot of questions.
We've got a lot of things that he needs to be able to answer.
But the thing is, in as much as, it keeps on coming back to number one, right? And we're saying that he needs to be held to account, and we know that he should appear in Parliament, that he should answer these questions. But Ranjani, and maybe this is just me being cynical, but it's reached a point whereby it seems that a lot of the stuff has just become really cosmetic. The president appears. He avoids and eludes questions. The EFF call him out on it. Maimani has definitely shaken up things at the DA. He calls him out on things. It becomes ugly. It becomes acrimonious. They're pointing fingers. They're saying things to each other way out of order. But the point is, the president walks away unscathed. Back to business. And that's why I think the president, to quote Stephen Grotius, that's why people get so annoyed with the fact that he just has that laugh, that giggle, that snigger that he walks away with.
I think the president is a master of kicking things into touch. He is able to delay things to say, I'll get back to you.
Yeah.
The hang 10. That's what he's done on Kandla. Now he's basically said that they have to wait for Nhleko's report, and then after that he'll answer. But now there's another prolonged process, because now it has to go back to Parliament. There has to be another ad hoc committee that has to look at Nhleko's report, and so it's going to be a while still before he has to answer whether he will pay or not, depending on what is in the police minister's report. But on other issues as well, where he just says it's going to happen very soon, and years can pass, unfortunately there aren't enough safety mechanisms and accountability mechanisms to be able to say, excuse me, you said, like, for example, last week I wrote that the public protector's report was released in March last year. She gave him 14 days to respond to the report. 1 year later,
here we are.
It's still not acted on, and absolutely, this is what happens.
I think I'm on a bit of a loss for words. I think our conversation on state institutions and
depressing.
It's a bit depressing. Anyway, on the Protea loss and. I mean, we need something to look forward to. We need something to,
But
Jenny's got something for us.
On the Protea loss, can you imagine for the next week on social media, on radio call-in shows, people would be moaning and groaning about it and things, and then it's gone. People, I wonder what's going to happen at the airport, if you're going to have like a reception committee for them, or if they're just going to limp home and go quietly. But the thing is, South Africa is, South Africans are master whiners. We know how to moan and groan, but we don't know how to act on issues.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's the big problem with it. The cricket will weep and cry and, scream about it for a while and then drop it. And the same thing will happen with Nkandla eventually. I think Nkandla would have been gone a long time ago if Julius Malema, the EFF, didn't keep it alive. I think that the same thing will happen with the roads issue. I think it'll, maybe the statue will come down, maybe it won't, but it'll peter out after a while. People get tired and go home. And, with the state institutions as well, you've got, this Hawks battle going on, and so South Africans have been spectators in this whole thing. You know, there's no process where we can say, "Excuse me, Mr. Minister, you know, we're being mugged on camera here. Can you like,
can you do something?
Yeah, can you do something? Yeah, you know, do your job and make sure that the police are doing their job instead of keep dragging them off to court."
That's horrific.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Ranjeni, I'm going to count to you. On the next show, I will be the voice of hope and sunlight. But anyway, just
bomb a really big,
it's just a big thank you to Daily Maverick contributor Gashel Brooks, Daily Maverick associate director Ranjeni. Thanks for joining us. And yeah, thanks for tuning in. We will see you next week.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com.